Okay, this is Claudia from the Great Lakes ADA Center. Just want to welcome everyone to our second session in the Legal Issues webinar series. We'll be starting in a couple minutes, just doing a test one more time.
Hi, this is Alan. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3.
That sounds good and clear, Alan. Barry, can we test yours one more time?
Hi, this is Barry.
Okay. I think we are good to get started. We're at the top of the hour, and we have a really interesting subject today. We're addressing the interplay between the desperate treatment and... Sorry there, dropped my mic. today's topic is desperate treatment and desperate impact claims under the ADA. What are they and why are they important? As you all know, and those who participated in the past, Barry Taylor from Equip for Equality is the Legal Advocacy Director, and Alan Goldstein from Equip for Equality, Senior Attorney, will be our speakers today. So I'd like to remind everyone, if they have any questions, to hold off till the question and answer portion. We encourage people to type their questions in the chat area over to the right, and we'll be reading those for our captioner during that time. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Alan and Barry.
Thanks, Claudia. Welcome, everyone. I'm Barry Taylor, and I'm going to start, and then Alan's going to follow up. You'll see in the webinar outline in front of you that first I'm going to give you a very brief overview of employment discrimination law, and then stop briefly just see if you have any questions after that. And then I think the more meaty part of the presentation, I'll turn it over to Alan to talk about disparate impact under the ADA. And then he'll also talk about some cases that have multiple issues. He's created the Name That Claim game as a way to make sure we're all on the same page as far as what the difference is between disparate impact and disparate treatment. One of the reasons we want to do this session is that I know some of you may be lawyers, but I know that a lot of you are not, but you're still reading ADA cases and ADA summaries, and a lot of times they'll throw out terms like disparate treatment, disparate impact, and it's unclear often what those terms mean. And so we wanted to make sure you understood what they meant, because these are really important to employers as well as employees to understand what these mean, and because the terminology is really important and can make the difference in how these cases play out both in court as well as in the workplace. So first we're going to start with an overview of employment discrimination law, and Alan's going to be turning the slides for me. We can go on to the next slide. And as I'm sure all of you know, that in order to be covered under civil rights law, you have to show that you're within a protected class. And most of the civil rights laws were passed in the 1960s, covering a variety of protected classes that you see on your screen. And then, of course, the ADA was added to this list in 1990 when it was passed and is now considered a protected class as well. And then within any employment discrimination case, including disability employment discrimination cases, there are always two different legal theories and sometimes three, depending on what the protected class is. The first one is always a possibility under any protected class is the most classic discrimination kind of claim, and that is disparate treatment. And basically that means you're claiming that you had some sort of adverse employment action because you belong to one of those protected classes that we looked at. And examples, a case that I handled here at Equip for Equality, there was a woman who was the supervisor, and she kept a diary about all of her employees, and she wrote in the diary about one of her employees who had heart disease, that if we keep her in this job for too much longer, our insurance rates are going to go way up. And they ended up terminating her right after they had written that down. And so that's a classic case of disparate treatment, where you're treating somebody differently because of their disability and not because of anything like performance. A trickier one is disparate impact, and that is when the person claims not that they're being treated directly, identifying a problem within disability, but that there's some sort of workplace rule or policy that is neutral on its face. It doesn't mention disability, but it has an impact, a discriminatory impact, on the people within that protected class. One of the first cases I ever handled involving disability discrimination involved a woman with multiple sclerosis who was a secretary, and she worked at a law firm. and the law firm had one of those neutral policies, and the neutral policy was they wanted all the secretaries at the end of every day to take any files they'd been working on and take them to a central location for filing at night. There was concerns about confidentiality and that sort of thing. And because of her disability, she had a very hard time lifting things, including the heavy files that the lawyers were creating for her. And so she was getting, she was experiencing problems in the workplace because she wasn't able to do that, and people were saying, well, you're not following this policy. We got involved and really said, look, this is a policy that discriminates against her. The impact is discriminatory. And we gave them a couple options. One was, we said, you know, this lifting isn't really an essential function of a secretary typically. It's more about filing and typing and that sort of thing. And this is something you could reassign to someone else because you can reassign non-essential functions. Or perhaps you give a reasonable accommodation of providing her a cart, and then she can move the files herself and without the lifting problems. And that's what they ended up doing. But you looked at that policy on its face. It has nothing to do with disability when you look at it, but it did have a discriminatory impact on her specifically. Hi, this is Barry. I was disconnected. I don't know if other people were as well. I don't see Claudia listed here, so she may be reconnecting. Okay, well, it looks like a lot of us were disconnected, maybe all of us. I'm not sure, but as I look at the participant list, it looks like people are back. Alan, I don't know if you can reload the PowerPoint. Thanks, Bonnie, for telling me that. I changed another setting. Is that better? Okay. Test. Is this better now? Great. I can't see the PowerPoint, Alan. I don't know if you need to refresh.
Hi, this is Alan. I tried refreshing it, and I actually reloaded it up. I can see it. Can anyone else see it?
Okay. I can't see the PowerPoint, but I have a paper version, so I think I can go on without having to see it myself, because I have a paper version in front of me. So it seems like everybody else can see it but me. So Annie, you said for us to wait until the captioner is back in. Can you advise when she's back, please?
Can anyone sing or provide some music while we're waiting?
Claudia, I see that you're back. Can you advise when we should start again? And Claudia, it seems like some people aren't able to see the PowerPoint and some people are. If you have any suggestions on what people should do to try to address that.
Hi, Claudia and Peter. When I came back, it was gone, so I reloaded it up. But I can see it now, and I've refreshed it a few times. But what's interesting, when it shows the slide number at the bottom when you're turning the slides, it keeps going back to zero, which makes me think that the system might be losing the PowerPoint or something.
Hi, Barry and Ellen. Little glitch there. I see you're in. I need you to go to the administration and send the current page and turn on follow me so everybody can be following with you.
Okay, how's that?
I can see it now. Great. So I think we're going to go ahead and start, and if people have any problems, just type it in and I'll try to respond to those more appropriately. Appreciate your patience. I think when we were all cut off. We were on slide number 6, and I was talking about disparate treatment, disparate impact, and Alan said that I was finishing my example of the secretary who had a disparate impact when she was required to lift heavy files as part of her job. That was a policy in the workplace, and ultimately was able to get a reasonable accommodation. The third theory, and again, I apologize if I'm repeating this for anybody, but the third theory that comes up in religious discrimination and disability cases is the failure to provide a reasonable accommodation, and that can arise in a variety of contexts like modifying people's work schedules, providing with alternate formats, assistive technology, that kind of thing. The reasonable accommodation can also be used to address a disparate impact policy, a policy that has a disparate impact, like I just suggested, with respect to the secretary in the law firm. The accommodation was to allow her to have a cart to carry the files at night. So in essence, they were able to keep the policy, but as long as they modified that policy for people with disabilities, it was fine to keep it in. One practical tip you'll see at the bottom of this slide is that it's really important to identify your theory of the case if you happen to be an an advocate or a person with a disability, because oftentimes courts will say if you don't identify your theory, then you may lose your ability to bring that theory as the case progresses. So just like when we talk about different types of the different prongs of disability, like actual disability versus regarded as and record of disability, if you're able to bring if you have facts to support a disparate treatment claim as well as a disparate impact claim, as well as a reasonable accommodation claim, it's okay to plead all three of them in the alternative. Let's go to the next slide, please. A couple other terms. One term that comes up a lot in cases you'll see is the term prima facie case, which is just a Latin term that talks about that you just need to put enough evidence to support your claim, and that if no one contradicted your claim, you've said enough to prove the case. And there's lots of cases out there that talk about how prima facie cases are what you put on should be flexible. Judges, especially with respect to people who sue without lawyers and really aren't familiar with certain terms, judges are usually much more flexible with those folks. And the prima facie case really depends on the particular case. Oftentimes they vary depending on the claims that you're bringing. But basically it's just to bring forth that the person is a person with a disability that's qualified, they've had an adverse act because of their disability, and the adverse act was by an entity that's covered by the ADA. That would mean an employer that has 15 or more employees. Next slide, please. A few other terms you'll see in cases: burden of proof. Basically, that's your burden to persuade either the jury or the judge that you've met the elements of your case, so that you are a person with a disability, that you do are qualified, and that you've been treated differently because of your disability. And all cases start with the employee having that first burden to prove those elements of their prima facie case that we talked about before. At that point, it then shifts to the employer to show that there was a non-discriminatory reason for the adverse action that's being alleged, or perhaps the person doesn't have a disability under the ADA, or things like that. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. The other thing, two other things listed on this slide. One is the standard of proof that you have to show in these kinds of cases is called preponderance of the evidence. And that means more likely than not. You're probably familiar with the term beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's really confined to criminal cases. And we're not talking about that. We're talking about civil cases. So the judge or the jury has to determine whether or not it's more likely than not that the employee is correct and that they were discriminated against in the workplace. And then the final term that you'll see a lot in these cases is called pretext. And basically what you're saying is that to cover up the real discriminatory motive, the defendant is putting forth some sort of false reason as to why they acted adversely towards the employee. So a classic example is the person was terminated because of poor performance, but it turns out that the real motive was person has a disability like HIV or epilepsy or mental illness that the employer wasn't comfortable with and did not want them in the workplace once it was discovered the person had the disability. So the pretext is the person wasn't performing well, but in actuality the real motive was based on the person's disability. So now let's move on to disparate treatment under the ADA. And the next slide has a quote from one of our Supreme Court justices, Justice Stewart, who's no longer on the bench, but he talked about how disparate treatment, as I referred to before, is really sort of the classic case of discrimination where the employer treats somebody differently just because they're in a protected class. And back then when Justice Stewart said this, it was before the ADA, but obviously ADA is now added to those other protected classes that are listed in his quote. And then the proof of discriminatory motive is also critical. A lot of times people think you have to show direct evidence of the discriminatory motive, but you can show it through inferring that there is some sort of discriminatory motive. So perhaps somebody was terminated, an employer terminated someone for not meeting the attendance policy, and they terminate somebody who happened to have a disability, and then someone else in the workplace who doesn't have a disability was not terminated when they violated the attendance policy. You would infer that the reason one was terminated and one wasn't, the only difference there, they both violated the policy. The only difference is one person has a disability and the other one doesn't. The plaintiff could allege that inferring from these facts that there was a discriminatory motive, and then it's up to the judge or the jury to decide whether, in fact, it was discrimination. Next slide, please. And then how you actually prove a case under the ADA, the prima facie case, you have to, as I said, show whether there was actual motivation of the employer's decision was based on disability. And we referred to this already, but just so we're on the same page, you have to show as the employee that you have the disability under the ADA, which is obviously a little easier to do these days now that we have the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act. Then you have to show the employee is a qualified individual, subject to an adverse action, and then this gets to where the preponderance of the evidence standard, that the circumstances indicate it's more likely than not that disability was the reason why they were treated differently in the workplace. So that's what the employee has to show in bringing a discrimination claim for disparate treatment. And then after the prima facie is established by the employee, that's when we have that shifting of burden that I referred to before. And that's when the employer gets the chance to tell their side of the story, to show that no, there wasn't discrimination here. There was a legitimate reason for the adverse action, and a legitimate reason why the person wasn't hired, or the reason why the person wasn't promoted, or the reason why the person was terminated was not related to disability. And it can be for a variety of reasons. One is maybe the person doesn't have a disability, or maybe they weren't qualified, or there's no reasonable accommodation that would enable them to be qualified. And you'll see some examples under there. Perhaps the person poses a direct threat, and so the safety issues were so vital, it was important to take some sort of adverse action. And maybe the person was terminated because they were laying off a bunch of people because we have a bad economy, a reduction in force. And just happens to be that one of the people laid off happened to be a person with a disability. That would be the kind of thing that the employer would respond when the burden shifts over to them. Next slide. And then once the burden is met by the employer, the presumption is that there was no intentional discrimination generally. However, there is still a possibility for the employee, and this is something I referred to when we were talking about the terms, and that is that there was some sort of actual discriminatory motive, and that the motive that the employer has put forth is pretextual, is actually false, and is covering up the real discriminatory motive underneath there. And you'll see a quote from the Tenth Circuit, which talks about pretext. So real quickly, we're going to talk about on the next slide proving pretext. And one thing I just want to mention, if you feel like this is going too fast, we are having a whole session in September that talks about pretext. There's a whole huge line of cases about pretext. And so we're going to give you just a little bit of an understanding of what it is so that it makes sense in the context of disparate treatment and disparate impact. But we want to delve into this in more detail in the September webinar that we have coming up. But real quickly, step one in proving pretext is you have to show the adverse action that we talked about. And it could be failure to hire, it could be termination, retaliation, that sort of thing. And then that moves to step two on the next slide, where the employer can rebut the disparate treatment by showing the legitimate non-discriminatory motive that we talked about before. And then the third part is really where the pretext comes up, and that is when the plaintiff, again, the burden shifts back to them to prove that the employer's explanation is not true. It's a pretext. And you can prove pretext in a lot of different ways. It can be people testifying, and maybe coworkers would testify, or you can cross-examine the witness who claimed it was a reason and then say, well, isn't it true that, in fact, it was done for this, and giving evidence and trying to get it out from the person who put out the first reason of non-discrimination, a non-discriminatory motive. You can also put forth documentary evidence. So that diary that was what the supervisor was keeping about the woman with the heart ailment, that was documentary evidence that would prove that it wasn't that the person was terminated because of poor performance, but was terminated because of the concern of them staying in the workplace and raising their insurance rate. Next slide. So when you prove disparate treatment, you can show what's called direct evidence and indirect evidence. And so the direct evidence, and again, we've referred to these already, are other employee comments, memos, any kind of observations in the workplace, things that actually happen within the workplace. But oftentimes you don't have that kind of evidence. And so you need to prove your case through what's called indirect evidence or circumstantial evidence. And this evidence is just as good as direct evidence as far as what it takes to prove an ADA case. But it does require somebody to infer something based on what you put forth. So, for instance, if you have inconsistent discipline where you provide a higher degree of discipline against an employee with a disability than you do with an employee without a disability, that would be indirect evidence. Or perhaps you've had 10 openings in the last year and people with disabilities applying for every one of those openings and no people with disabilities were hired. That would be indirect evidence of failure to hire people with disabilities. Now, of course, then the employer can say, well, the reason we didn't hire those people with disabilities is because in every case we had somebody who was more qualified, and then it would be a factual determination by the jury and the judge. Unfair negative performance reviews related to disability, increased oversight after somebody asked for reasonable accommodation, all those are examples of indirect evidence that can also be put forth. And then a third factor that can come up is what's called a mixed motive for a decision. And this is a pretty complicated area of law, but basically what mixed motive is that there's been proof that there was a non-discriminatory reason and a discriminatory reason for the adverse action. So maybe there were some performance problems, but there was also evidence that the person was terminated because of their disability. That's a mixed motive. And then it goes to the jury or the judge to decide, well, really how much of the decision was based on the disability and how much of it was based on other things that were not discriminatory, like poor performance. And that's something the judge or jury decides in weighing the evidence. And then that can translate to maybe if you say, well, a quarter of the reason why they did it was based on disability, but really most of it was on the basis of poor performance. Well, that would affect the person's damages that they could receive, because most of the reason why the person wasn't kept on in the workplace was not related to their disability, but some was, and so they might be entitled to some damages. But if there's enough of a reason maybe to terminate somebody based on something other than disability, then the employer would have a strong argument that the employee would not be entitled to a reinstatement, because even though there may have been some discrimination in the decision to terminate, if there was enough discrimination to terminate them based on non-discriminatory factors like poor performance, then the employer would be likely successful in arguing that the person would not be entitled to be reinstated. Next slide. A real quick example of a case involving disparate treatment and policies. A lot of times when I referred to before, I talked about disparate impact, that it was a neutral policy. Well, it's possible to also have a policy that is not neutral on its face and that can be discriminatory. And if you have a policy that is not neutral on its face and is discriminatory, that's disparate treatment, even though it's a policy as opposed to some sort of action in the workplace. The Taylor versus Rice case is a really good example. In that case, Mr. Taylor wanted to be an officer with the Foreign Service. He disclosed that he had HIV, and at the time, the United States had a policy that you could not be in the Foreign Service if you had HIV, and the rationale was you needed to be able to be deployed on a worldwide basis and that you could be deployed to places that did not have sufficient medical support for somebody with HIV. But rather than sort of examining that person and the particular countries they're going to and that sort of thing to be qualified, it was more of a blanket policy, and everybody with HIV was excluded from this particular position. And originally the trial court had thought that the person would be a direct threat to themselves, and therefore the employer's policy was not going to be doing discrimination under the ADA. But when it was appealed up to the D.C. Circuit Court, they said that the employer failed to address any sort of reasonable accommodations that would reduce this direct threat, and that on the face of it, you had a policy that was treating this person differently than people without disabilities, and then if you were able to accommodate them, then that person could still be a Foreign Service officer. So one thing would be maybe limit their assignments to places where there would be sufficient medical support, or perhaps allow the person leave from the particular country they were in that didn't have the medical support to go to a country that did have medical support. And so even though if you read that case, they probably don't use the word disparate treatment throughout the whole case. It's a disparate treatment case because if you look at the policy, it talks about treating somebody with HIV differently than somebody else. It's not a neutral policy. It's clearly directed to one type of disability in a protected class. So real briefly, I'm going to just go over a couple tips for employees. Next slide. One of the first tips is that it's really important for employees with disabilities and advocates who are advising them to address the employer's conduct and complain to the supervisor, especially in cases of harassment by coworkers, and that to address the conduct that's offensive or potentially discriminatory in a contemporaneous manner. So don't wait too long to bring it up. It's better evidence if you do it right away. Also, keeping good documentation of any type of conduct that seems to be discriminatory, and doing that in a timely fashion is also important. If there's any kind of injury that arises from the wrongful conduct in the workplace, providing that proof to the employer to show what happened so that the employer can't say they weren't on notice. Also should be aware of statute of limitations. Generally, the rule is that you need to file within 180 days of the adverse action if you're in a state that has what's called a work share agreement with your local human rights department. That date, number of days, can be extended up to 300 days. And as I alleged before, it's important to allege all possible claims as a plaintiff, as an employee. And we cite the Timmons case, which said that they failed to bring up the failure to accommodate claim sufficiently, and therefore it was deemed waived because it wasn't raised clearly in the original complaint. And then some quick tips for the employers. Next slide, please. One is, and this is really important, making sure that managers are trained on the ADA, especially new hires, so that they know what the law is and what their responsibilities are under the ADA. In addition to training, I think it's important to retrain, especially when there are new developments coming out. We have the new ADA Amendments Act that just came out, and I think it's important for people to be retrained because it really has changed how the law is going to be interpreted by the courts because of what Congress has done. Really important also that employers properly define the essential job functions so it's clear what's essential, what's not, making sure that you're not having things in your job policies that don't relate to an essential function like the lifting requirements we talked about. Modifying any anti-discrimination or anti-harassment training that you have to include disability training. A lot of times you'll have sexual harassment trainings that are done, but there's a lot of potential disability harassment issues that can arise too. And so broadening any kind of training you do to include disability is important. Making sure that the disability accommodation and harassment policies are in place and have appropriate grievance procedures, and then that they're followed. It's really problematic for employers to have policies in place that aren't followed. So it's important to have the policies and then have training and then follow through that the policies are complied with as set forth. Important to obviously document any performance and safety issues in case there's a potential direct threat claim. And then also I think probably this is, along with retraining and training, being consistent is really important, especially when it comes to disparate treatment. We talked about how you can prove disparate treatment through indirect evidence, and one of those examples of indirect evidence is when the employer is inconsistent. They treat maybe a person with a disability differently than they treat people without disabilities, and that's a good example of indirect evidence and leads to an inference of disparate treatment. So again, if you're not consistent with enforcing an attendance policy or some other policy, and you're adversely enforcing it against a person with a disability, that can be deemed disparate treatment against you. And just really important to be ready to make those reasonable accommodations that we discussed, engage in the interactive process, and do it in a timely manner. And then one other tip that I skipped over is when we're talking about consistency, sometimes the consistency is not that the one person is inconsistent, but you have inconsistent actions by different managers. And so one way to avoid that is to be centralized in decision makings that have to come up with things like reasonable accommodations and enforcement of attendance policies and that sort of thing. And that way you have consistent decisions across an organization. So with that, I'll just open up, see if there's any quick questions on disparate treatment. and then we'll move to disparate impact. And as you can see, Alan's got a good visual for you for disparate impact, and we'll continue on with the meat of the program. Any questions for so far? Okay, with that, I'll turn it over to Alan, and if people have questions later on disparate treatment at the end, we'll have time for questions as well. Alan?
Okay, thank you, Barry, and thank you, Claudia. And if at any time the mic goes out or anything, please type in or something so I'm aware of it, because otherwise I'll just be going ahead helter-skelter. So we're going to talk about disparate impact. Barry did a really nice job laying out disparate treatment, where really the motive is the key. And then the second type of discrimination is disparate impact, which we'll talk about. The third type, which we pointed out earlier, was reasonable accommodation. And we're not going to have a separate topic for that, but that really ties in to disparate impact. And we'll see in some of these cases, it's clear that a policy is facially neutral and that it may have a disparate impact. Other policies may be disparate treatment policies, like the one in the case involving the State Department and people who are HIV positive. That was a policy that was not facially neutral. And some of them could be a bit of a gray area. And toward the end of the presentation, we'll see that courts have somewhat wrestled with plugging the ADA into these disparate impact, disparate treatment types of theories, which are really from Title VII Civil Rights Act litigation. And then courts have kind of been fashioning an ADA approach to these issues. But for now, we're going to talk about disparate impact, which involves employment practices that are facially neutral in their treatment of different groups, but have a significantly adverse impact or effect on a protected group compared to others. Motive, a discriminatory motive, is not required. These could be well-meaning policies with no intent at all to discriminate, but they still might have the effect of discriminating through a disparate impact. And like Barry talked about with the burden shifting, there's a very similar three-part proof process that was codified on the Civil Rights Act of 1991. And it is very similar. First, the employee has to establish that there's a disparate impact on a protected class. Once they make out that prima facie case, then the burden shifts and the employer now must come forward and demonstrate a business necessity for the practice or policy or procedure. And by business necessity, especially under the ADA, it's defined as being job-related and mandated by business necessity. So it's going to be a factual, specific inquiry in terms of whether the policy is in effect for that particular position that the person holds. And if the employer shows that there is a business necessity for that practice, then the burden shifts back to the plaintiff to show that the reason is pretext. Well, they say it's a neutral policy, but really it's really setting up some type of discrimination. Or a person can also show in an ADA case that there's an alternative process that's equally effective that does not have a disparate impact, or that a reasonable accommodation when put into this policy will enable someone with a disability to not suffer a disparate impact based on the policy. So we're going to look at an old Title VII case from 1971, Griggs versus Duke Power. And this kind of lays out, how disparate impact looks. And in this case, an employer required job applicants for certain positions to either have a high school degree or to pass a standard intelligence test. And for this position, African Americans were disqualified at a substantially higher rate than quote-unquote white applicants due to this policy. Also, looking at the position historically, only white employees have held those jobs. But there was no showing whatsoever that the policy was put in place for a discriminatory purpose. There was no motive to discriminate. That may be questionable, but on its face, it is a neutral policy. But there was also no showing that the standard or the policy was really significantly related to successful job performance. And that's where we get into the job-related nature of the analysis. In this case, the lower courts found no discrimination because there was no discriminatory intent. The employer basically put forth the position, we're the employer, we can set forth the policies we think we need to set forth. And unless we have an intent and a motive to discriminate, those policies should be upheld by the courts. And the lower court in this situation agreed with that. But when it got to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court reversed both the district court and the appellate court. And Chief Justice Berger, writing for the Supreme Court, wrote, and I quote, "Good intent or absence of discriminatory intent does not redeem employment procedures or testing mechanisms that operate as built-in headwinds for minority groups and are unrelated to measuring job capability." So the Chief Justice said motive does not matter in disparate impact. If it has the effect of discriminating, that's enough to raise a discrimination claim. Very, very important decision for employees and for employers. And then looking at the ADA actually has a provision which relates specifically to disparate impact. It says employers may not use qualification standards, employment tests, or other selection criteria that screen out or tend to screen out an individual with a disability or a class of individuals with disabilities unless the standard test or other selection criteria as used by the covered entity is shown to be job related for the position in question and is consistent with business necessity. So what it's saying is if a policy screens out or tends to screen out people with disabilities, it's still okay if the employer can show that it is consistent with business necessity and related to the job in question. But unless the employer can show that, then that policy or that selection criteria or that employment test would not be okay. And there is some EEOC guidance on the use of selection criteria. Under the resources, I have a couple of links to some information from the EEOC in this area. And it says the purpose is really to ensure a fit between the job criteria and an applicant or employee's actual ability to do the job. And the EEOC asserts that even job criteria that unintentionally screen out individuals with disabilities should not be used unless those criteria are used in a manner that is job related to the position and are consistent with business necessity. And selection criteria that do not concern an essential job function, according to the EEOC, would never be consistent with business necessity. It must relate to an essential job function in order to satisfy the job related and business necessity criteria. And we have here some policies that may have a disparate impact if not reasonably modified. For example, a facility that requires a driver's license as a form of identification when driving is not part of the job and is not an essential function. They just want the license as ID. And in some cases, the employers will refuse to accept, for example, an official state ID instead of a driver's license. And courts and the EEOC guidance says, well, even though this policy is neutral on its face, it has an impact of discriminating against people with disabilities because many people with disabilities might not be able to drive due to their disability. So that can be modified by accepting some other official type of identification. In a case that our agency, Equip for Equality, worked on, Carriker versus Rent-A-Center, Rent-A-Center used the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory personality test for job applicants. And the court said that test has the effect of discriminating against people with mental illness, and it's also possible that these tests might discriminate against people with other types of disabilities, for example, cognitive disabilities. And what's interesting is our agency wrote an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief on this case, and we had a whole section, I pulled up our brief to look it over again, we had a whole section talking about disparate impact. And even though the court sided with our position in the case, in the court decision, they never mention disparate impact in the analysis. They really just look to see whether there's an effect of discrimination. And it could be argued that since it's a personality test, it might be more of a discriminatory or a disparate treatment because it is going to personality, which can, again, relate to mental illness. Another policy which courts have found to be violative of the ADA are when businesses have 100% healed or a fully healed policy to return to work, usually after medical leave or something like that. Courts have found that these are not acceptable under the ADA. They do not leave room for an individualized assessment. And even though these are often looked at as disparate impact, because you're talking about healed and a physical condition, it might be possible to say that some of these might have a disparate treatment type of effect as well. And another similar policy that's been found to violate the ADA are policies that tell employees either return to work after 1 year on leave or you're terminated. And these policies, too, have been found to violate the ADA. And as noted in the bottom, many times a court uses an ADA or reasonable accommodation type of analysis should the policy be modified, even if it does fit into a disparate impact situation. And then we have some policies listed here, and we're going to look at some cases that involve these very policies. But very briefly, what about a policy that grants reassignment based on seniority? Obviously a neutral policy, but could that have a discriminatory impact? Or a policy forbidding hiring or rehiring former employees who were terminated for cause or resigned in lieu of termination? Could that have a disparate impact? A standard that drivers of smaller trucks must meet a hearing standard that Department of Transportation sets for larger trucks. And that could be a disparate impact analysis, although that might fit more under a disparate treatment because it's looking directly at hearing. But then the question comes, how do you analyze this type of policy? There's a policy in a case involving American Online where they required that tech support staff be able to work online and offer tech support and on the phone and offer tech support, even if they don't have to do any phone work for the online support. Even if some positions require absolutely no phone work, AOL required that everyone who does non-phone tech support must have had phone experience. And that had an impact against people who are deaf or hard of hearing. Policy that prison chaplains meet physical fitness requirements. We'll look at that in terms of disparate impact. One facility assigned workstations on a first-come, first-served basis, but an employee with a wheelchair was often late getting to work or getting back from lunch due to a lack of accessible parking. And because this place also had a strict tardiness policy, this employee was disciplined. And he argued that the first-come, first-serve workstation policy had a disparate impact on him. And one thing, we don't have a case on this, but this is something I think it's important and should be in everyone's mind. Now, when people apply online for jobs, even if it's a very basic entry-level position, often people have to complete a lengthy, somewhat complex online pre-employment test, which really doesn't seem to be specifically related to the job, whether it's bagging groceries or doing custodial work. The test doesn't really seem to talk about any of that, and it's often very long, can take a half an hour or more to fill out. And one question we wonder is, under the court's decision in Carriker, which really called into question whether a lot of these tests can be job-related and consistent with business necessity, one question that comes up is, are these requiring that applicants fill out these tests, is that policy that applicants must fill it out, does that have a disparate impact on people with disabilities? So first we'll look at the Barnett case. This is a U.S. Supreme Court case, and many of you may be familiar with it, but this isn't based on a collective bargaining agreement, but U.S. Airways had a policy that they give, where they bid positions, open positions, based on seniority. And a person who, due to their disability, was no longer able to do their current job wanted to be reassigned, even though they lacked the necessary seniority. And the question is, must a policy granting reassignment based on seniority be modified as a reasonable accommodation? And the court said, not necessarily, but sometimes. And the court said neutral rules, which this is, do not automatically trump reasonable accommodation requests. And they looked at the congressional intent behind the ADA. They said, however, if the policy is uniformly applied and the company consistently applies the seniority policy, then they do not have to modify it as a reasonable accommodation. However, if the individual seeking the new position can show that the policy or the seniority provision was not strictly followed in other cases, and there were a lot of exceptions, then the company may need to modify their seniority policy. If not, then the seniority policy, if it's consistently applied, will trump a request for reassignment. And in this decision, the court refers to accommodations, reasonable accommodations, as special and preferential. And basically, they never mention disparate impact, even though they do mention specifically that this is a neutral workplace rule, which I found interesting. And they really went through a reasonable accommodation type of analysis. And the court also went out of its way to point out some problems of allowing neutral workplace rules to have veto power over accommodations. And they just threw out some examples. For example, neutral office assignment rules would prevent accommodation of an employee whose limitations require work on the ground floor. Or neutral break from work rules would prevent the accommodation of an individual who needs extra breaks from work, either for medical visits or someone with diabetes needs to monitor their blood sugar or something like that. Court even pointed out the neutral furniture budget rules might prevent the accommodation of an individual who needs a different kind of chair or desk based on disability. And so that's the Barnett case, and that comes from the Supreme Court. Another case I wanted to discuss, which had a whole host of policies, is Hendricks Robinson versus Excel. And this is a meat company, a meat packing company, and they had the following policies: reserving light duty positions for employees with temporary, keyword, medical restrictions. Once an employee was in one of these light duty positions and their restrictions were deemed permanent, they were removed from the light duty position, even though they were doing it fine, and forced onto medical leave. Then after they were on medical leave for 1 year, they were terminated due to a policy terminating people on leave 1 year. The company also had a no rehire policy that they don't rehire former employees. And then they also had a policy that job applicants must meet the qualifications of a job and have equal physical fitness, quote unquote, as other candidates. That policy was in question. And the company also was seemingly playing some games, telling employees they would automatically bid for the non-production lighter jobs, which wasn't the case, and the non-production jobs were only posted in the plant, which employees on leave did not have access to, and then they were only posted for 2 days. So it was really impossible for an employee on leave who needed a lighter job to bid on these non-production jobs. And I just wanted to read a short excerpt from the case about meatpacking. This is a case, and in some of these cases we'll see that the essential functions are quite important. Excel's meat, and this is from the case, Excel's meatpacking plant in Beardstown, Illinois, slaughters, cuts, and packages approximately 15,000 hogs daily. They have between 1,600 and 1,800 employees, 85% of whom are on production lines slaughtering hogs, and those on the production lines work hard, usually under uncomfortable condition. Their tasks are often heavy and include much repetitive handwork that must be performed quickly and precisely. And the rate of injuries among such workers is not unexpectedly high, the court says in a nice example of understatement. So then the court looked at all these policies. So one, reserving light duty positions for employees with temporary medical restrictions, the court actually said that policy is okay. And there's been some litigation on this issue in various cases. And I think the tip for employers on this is if you want to have a position that's designated as temporary as people recover from work injuries or from other medical conditions, but you want it to be a temporary condition, it's really best to make sure that these positions are designated as temporary and everyone knows up front it's temporary. In this case, the employees were sometimes pulled from jobs and never knew that their position on a lighter job was temporary, and then was shocked to learn that because their limitations were deemed permanent, they were taken off the job, which they were doing fine, due to their inability to perform their previous job, which they were not able to do due to limitations. The court looked at the company policy of forcing working employees who were able to do their current jobs onto medical leave, and the court held that that violated the ADA. They also looked at the policy requiring that applicants have equal physical fitness as other candidates, and the court said that was not okay. The applicants were already deemed to be qualified, so adding that extra step of physical fitness, which one is vague, and two, not really allow for an individualized assessment, was not allowed. And while most of these policies might be some disparate impact, this one seems to be more of a disparate treatment type of policy. It's kind of showing how some of these cases get blended together. However, legitimate weightlifting or legitimate job requirements are okay, and we have a case there, I'm not sure if it's pronounced Fuzzy or Fuzzy, but in that case, the employer had a weightlifting requirement that a pipe fitter needed to lift 100 pounds. And that requirement was based on Department of Labor standards. And the court said that that's fine to have that requirement. If someone can lift 100 pounds, even if it's because of a disability, and no accommodation will let them lift that weight, then they're not qualified. And I would raise the issue whether a Department of Labor standard really is an individualized assessment of the job in question, but the court didn't address that issue and held that the 100-pound requirement was fine. And then getting back to Hendricks Robinson, the court also said that terminating employees after 1 year on leave also violated the ADA. And it's interesting, the court used a reasonable accommodation analysis in reaching its conclusions, and also noted fairly strongly that the employer did not engage in the interactive process, and at some point seemed to actually mislead people. Employees had no access to the non-production jobs, and the employees were deceived about being automatically bid for non-production jobs. They were told they would be bid for them, but they weren't. And just so I complete my essential function litany, some of the non-production jobs, or some of the regular production jobs that were deemed lighter duty, which these people were not able to get, were jobs such as trimming thyroids, turning hogs, trimming butts, ten skinner, front foot cutoff, ham boning, and combo makeup. So those were some of the lighter jobs. So in this tough economy, if people are looking for new jobs and you feel like doing some ham boning, I guess Excel might be a place to go. And then real quickly, I want to look at the Convergys case. This was, I alluded to this earlier, they had a strict tardiness policy and also allocated workstations first come, first serve. An employee used a wheelchair and was often late. There was no accessible parking. The stations were filled when he got there. And he just wanted to be accommodated by coming back late from lunch or a little extra time to return from lunch. For example, instead of saying, I have to be back at 1, can you make it? I have to be back at 1:15. And the court held implying the employee an extra 15 minutes to return from lunch did not require eliminating an essential function, punctuality. It only created a different time for measuring punctuality. And again, a reasonable accommodation analysis was used there. And as I mentioned, sometimes it's a combination of issues, and it's hard to plug it into disparate treatment, disparate impact, reasonable accommodation, because it can be in more than one category. And when we get to the Supreme Court decision in Raytheon versus Hernandez, an employee was forced to resign after testing positive for cocaine in violation of workplace rules. More than 2 years later, after successful rehabilitation, he applied to be rehired. And the employee says, no, we have an unwritten policy against rehiring employees terminated for misconduct or who quit in lieu of termination. And sometimes it's interesting, maybe it's the fact that I'm an advocate, but whenever I hear an unwritten policy asserted once a lawsuit's filed, I always wonder, was it really a policy, or is it just something that they're saying now to justify their conduct? And in this case, it's not really clear which. And just a note there, the ADA does not protect individuals due to current use of illegal drugs, but people with a history of illegal drug use may be protected if they meet the ADA's or one of the ADA's definitions of disability. In the Raytheon case, it was interesting because the HR decision maker who rejected Mr. Hernandez's application said, I never even knew he had used drugs. I just saw that he had resigned in lieu of discharge before and knew that we couldn't hire him. But the Supreme Court didn't really go into the facts of this. I looked at the appellate court decision, and the appellate court noted that the decision maker, even though she said she didn't know that he had used drugs in the past, the decision maker pulled his entire personnel file. So the information was in the personnel file. The drug test results were in the personnel file. And interestingly, the recent application that the employee submitted to be rehired had a reference letter from a counselor at Alcoholics Anonymous. Yet the Supreme Court seemed to buy the company position that, oh, we had no idea that he was a person with a disability. Even more interesting in this case, the manager of diversity development for Raytheon said to the EEOC that the application was rejected based on the demonstrated drug use and a complete lack of evidence indicating successful drug rehabilitation. And in fact, there was evidence indicating successful rehab. The diversity director also said the company maintains its right to deny reemployment to employees terminated for violation of company rules. And then the employee, of course, filed at the EEOC, which is why the diversity director got to speak to the EEOC, claiming that he was protected of having either a record of drug addiction or being regarded as being a drug user. And the EEOC, after their investigation, found reasonable cause that a violation occurred. Regarding the disparate impact claim, the court held that it was barred. The employee raised disparate impact, disparate treatment, and request for an accommodation. The court held it was barred, the disparate impact claim, because it was not raised prior to the close of discovery. But again, looking back in this case, the employer never mentioned that they had this unwritten policy of not rehiring people terminated for cause until the case was before the court in summary judgment after all discovery and information was exchanged. And that's when the employee first said, well, if that's what they're saying, then that policy has a disparate impact. And the court says, well, no, you're raising disparate impact too late, and barred the employee from pursuing that, but I don't know how the employee could have raised it earlier because they never knew about the policy until summary judgment. And then the court said, well, we're only going to look at disparate treatment in this case. And we're looking at the appellate court now. We're going to look at disparate treatment now. He raised a prima facie case of disparate treatment, but because the neutral, unwritten policy can result in discrimination, it can never be a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for its rejection. That's the second step of the disparate treatment analysis. And that's the appellate court. And then when it gets to the Supreme Court, Justice Thomas framed the issue as whether the ADA confers preferential hiring rights, or rehire rights, on disabled employees who were lawfully terminated. I'm not sure if that really is a proper phrasing of the issue. It seems like it's a little sternly worded, I think. I don't know if he's really looking for preferential rehiring rights. He's just looking to not be discriminated against based on his status as a person with disability. And the court held both disparate treatment and disparate impact claims are cognizable under the ADA. It agreed with the appellate court that the disparate impact claim was raised too late, but it disagreed and said the appellate court improperly applied a disparate impact analysis to a disparate treatment claim. So it looked at the effect of the policy. The policy had the effect of discriminating against people who had used drugs, but was it really the motive behind it? The court said if you're looking at disparate treatment, you don't look at the effect, you look at the motive. And the court went on to say that that policy was a quintessential, legitimate, non-discriminatory reason. And then I have some questions about this case. Did the diversity manager's statement say we have a right not to hire people who use drugs? Isn't that showing a disparate treatment motive? The court never addressed the diversity manager's statements. And in fact, his statements weren't in the Supreme Court decision, only the appellate court decision. And what I raised before, when should Hernandez have raised a disparate impact claim if he didn't know about the unwritten policy until summary judgment? I'm not sure what the answer is, and we'll see in one decision, the court says, well, the employer just needs to raise them, whether they know that there was a reason behind the termination, or even if they were just told, I'm sorry, the position was filled, the court sometimes put the onus on the person with a disability to raise that claim or risk having the statute of limitations run. Would Hernandez have won if they looked at disparate impact? That, of course, is not addressed, because the court said we won't even look at that issue, but it's a possibility. And then for employees who are not hired and failure to hire, how can an employee ever know the real motivation for a decision? And then was the employer really insulated from liability because he claimed the decision maker didn't even know of the disability? As I mentioned, the Supreme Court decision kind of glossed over that, but looking at the appellate court decision, it's possible the HR decision maker did know of his disability since she pulled the whole file and there was a reference from Alcoholics Anonymous. So those are I found the case somewhat troubling for these reasons, as you can probably tell. And again, this was after the Barnett case, so Barnett may not have raised disparate impact because the Supreme Court didn't really even decide until the Hernandez-Raytheon case whether disparate impact and disparate treatment applied to ADA cases. Then once it said that they did, courts found other trouble in trying to analyze these cases. In the AOL case, jobs available for external hire and tech support were only voice phone positions. And this was because they found a call center in the Philippines which did non-voice phone, the online typing type of tech support, and they wanted to do that in the Philippines and didn't want to hire anyone new for that. So in 1997, AOL changed their policy that only non-voice phone positions would be in the Philippines, which then required that anyone who wanted to work non-voice phone would have had to have some voice phone experience. And the question was, would voice phone experience, is it really an essential function for working on the non-voice phone positions? And again, by non-voice phone, I just mean mostly typing on the computer. Before 1997, people who were deaf handled both, handled the non-voice phone position without a problem. An applicant who was deaf desired one of the tech support non-voice phone positions, and AOL said that's only available internally. And then the question is, voice phone experience, an essential function of the non-voice phone positions. And the court again looked at the three types of discrimination that Barry outlined, treating a qualified individual's disability differently because of the disability, that's disparate treatment, qualification standards that screen out or tend to screen out people with disabilities, that's disparate impact, and then not making reasonable accommodations. And the court said no matter what theory you use, the first thing a person has to do is establish they're qualified. And the court says this is a disparate treatment case, and again, it's possible to maybe say it's disparate impact just because they're saying you need voice phone experience to do non-voice phone work, but which would impact someone who's deaf, but the court says that to them that was more obviously disparate treatment and showed some type of motive. So they looked at it as a disparate treatment case where McDonnell-Douglas burden shifting generally applies. And I have the query there, is it also disparate impact? I think possibly, but the court didn't delve into that. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to go a little quickly here because we're running a little late because of the glitches before, but we'll certainly leave enough time for questions and everything. So the court said generally McDonnell-Douglas burden shifting applies to disparate treatment, but in this case it's really unnecessary. The employer admits that, you know, someone who's deaf could never do the non-voice phone work because they now require the non-voice phone people to have voice phone experience. So it really doesn't have to go back and forth in terms of pretext. So the court said the key to our decision is whether Davidson is a qualified individual, and that's a factual dispute resolved through traditional methods of proof. And I think that's the key of this decision. They said on these ADA cases, plugging him into disparate impact or treatment is hard. Let's look at an ADA analysis. Are they qualified? And one thing, too, AOL asserted, well, the non-voice phone positions weren't even available for outside people. But the ADA says that an applicant or an employee who feels they've been discriminated against in applying for a job that they hold or a job that they desire can raise that. And the court said, well, he desired the non-voice phone positions, and the fact that they were not available externally was only due to AOL's policy. So the court went through a qualified analysis, and really that brings in all the ADA issues we've talked about. It brings in reasonable accommodation because a person must be qualified to perform the essential job functions with or without a reasonable accommodation. So it brings in accommodation issues, job function issues, and it could also bring in safety concerns if those are evident. And then another case, and one thing I wanted to mention too, this case is Jeffrey versus Ashcroft. Was the Bureau of Prisons and places involving federal employees are analyzed under the Rehabilitation Act, which has the same analysis as the ADA, but it is a different law ostensibly, so it's important to keep that in mind. Here, the Bureau of Prisons terminated a chaplain with chronic pulmonary disease because they failed the physical abilities tests. And the court notes both parties have struggled to present it in either disparate treatment or disparate impact. And the court said, well, neither one is really pertinent here. I mean, it is a policy, but it is a disparate treatment type of policy because it is a physical abilities test. But the court, you know, looked at the AOL decision and said, you know, really neither analysis works here. The criteria is not facially neutral for disparate impacts, but for disparate treatment, the burden shifting approach doesn't make sense either, where the employer's reliance on the employee's physical or mental impairments is obvious. And so the court used the AOL framework, reasonable accommodation qualified analysis framework. It looked at treatment of others in the same position. There was insufficient evidence to show that passing the test was related to an essential job function in terms of having done the voice phone work, the physical abilities test was related to essential function. It doesn't come up too much for chaplains. Chaplains hired before 1997 weren't required to take it. I think for this chaplain, they waived it when he first applied. And it was waived for other applicants. That's relevant. So I think for all those reasons, the court looked at that analysis and said, well, the chaplain should not have been terminated. And I want to look at UPS versus Bates. This is where UPS used the Department of Transportation standards for large trucks, the hearing standards for drivers of larger trucks over 10,000 pounds, and took those standards and then applied it to their drivers who drove smaller trucks. So there is no Department of Transportation hearing standard for the smaller trucks, but UPS just adopted the larger truck standard and used it in their company. And this is a class action. Hard of hearing and deaf employees and applicants challenged the policy and won in district court. UPS was barred from using the blanket policy, and the court said you have to do an individualized assessment. UPS said, well, it's a safety standard. People who can't meet this hearing standard can't drive safely no matter what the size of the truck. And the district court said, well, that's a blanket policy. The ADA requires individualized assessment. That's what you need to do. And then the case went up to the appellate court, and the court said the ADA's business necessity defense, remember the job-related consistent with business necessity, it can be asserted against any kind of claim, disparate treatment, disparate impact, failure to accommodate. And it said, too, as the other case said, when something's facially discriminatory, as in here, the burden-shifting approach just doesn't work. The employer instead must show that the standard tests or criteria are job-related and consistent with business necessity, and that performance cannot be accomplished by reasonable accommodation. The court further noted the business necessity standard is quite high. It's not just mere expediency. It's not just the business saying we wanted to do it, so we did it. And it's a fact-intensive analysis that requires a close look. And because UPS has linked hearing with safe driving, because it was a safety issue, kind of getting into the direct threat type of issue, even though the employee normally has to show they're qualified, because it's a safety direct threat type of situation, the burden was put on UPS to show that their policy, their hearing requirement, was linked with safe driving. And the court, again, used a direct threat analysis because it's a safety requirement. And in direct threat, that's a defense, so the burden for those situations does fall on the employer under the statute. The employer must validate the test or exam for job relatedness to the specific skills and physical requirements of the position. And we'll talk a little about validating. That's a whole other ballgame in terms of validating tests, which requires extensive analysis. But it's up to the employer to do that. They must show that the qualification standard fairly and accurately measures the individual's actual ability to perform essential functions. The employer must demonstrate a predictive or significant correlation between the qualification and performance of the essential functions, and must also put forth evidence establishing those functions and why they're essential. The standard must substantially promote the business needs, and the fact that UPS used a government standard, even though for a different truck size, it's some evidence, it has some relevance, but the court said it wasn't the end of the game. You can't just take one standard that's used for one size truck and then just adopt it for another size truck and then say it automatically applies. There needs to be that analysis there. The employees must still show they're qualified to perform the essential function of safely driving, whether or not they meet that hearing standard. This is something the district court did not really make a finding about, so it was sent back to the lower court to do that. And it says the employee does not bear the burden to invalidate the safety-based qualification standard. Rather, the employer bears the burden to validate it. The employee doesn't have to invalidate it. I'm sorry if I meant before. But the employee does not have to invalidate the safety-based standard. The employer has the burden of validating it. And here it looked at the basic qualifications for a package car driver position, and it said an employee who meets it, enough seniority, 21 years of age, a valid driver's license, and they can drive a package car safely, they have a clean driving record and can pass the driving test, then they're otherwise qualified. End of story. And now we're going to have some tips for employees with disabilities regarding disparate impact. One, inform employers if it negatively impacts you. And you can ask that the policy be rescinded, or more often than not, it's usually asked that the policy be reasonably modified to avoid discrimination. And I think it's worthwhile to explain why a person's negatively impacted by the policy. If the disability or the need for the accommodation is not obvious, the person with the disability may need to submit additional medical documentation, limited in scope, which is showing an ADA disability and a reasonable accommodation. And it's always a good idea when communicating with management in accommodation situations to ask for a timely response, for example, 2 weeks. And, of course, be abreast and aware of time filing requirements and deadlines. And one thing, too, for federal employees, it's not the 180 days or the 300 days Barry talked about. Federal employees don't have to file something within 45 days, but they need to report it to their EEO officer or the EEO Equal Employment Officer within 45 days. So for federal employees, it's a much, much shorter timeline. Some more tips for employees. Again, allege all possible claims. The one Timmons case, you don't want the court to say, oh, you allege disparate treatment, but it's a failure to accommodate case. You want to allege everything that applies to the facts. And a charge alleging an employer says, we don't hire disabled people, is really disparate treatment. So if you wanted to raise an accommodation claim, you need to put that in the case as well. And this is from the Boldridge case, where they were not allowed to raise an accommodation claim because it was just disparate treatment. We don't hire disabled people. And it held that statement was not reasonably related to charges of disparate impact, failure to hire, accommodate, or prohibited inquiries. The person only put that one line in the EEOC charge and were later held to be deemed limited to only raising a disparate treatment claim. And again, due to exhaustion requirements, charges not raised at the appropriate stage are waived. And this is true even if the investigation lists other violations. So make sure when you file the EEOC charge that you list every possible type of claim. And now some tips for employers. One, I think it's best to look at the ADA cases under a qualified reasonable accommodation type of analysis. I mean, you can also be aware of the disparate impact, disparate treatment stuff, but really focus on the ADA and individualized assessment, essential functions, reasonable accommodation. Is the person qualified? Is the accommodation request reasonable? Is an employer's reason for denying it job-related and consistent with business necessity? And again, employers must be ready to show either a decision or a test or a criteria meets that job-related business necessity standard. And same thing with disparate impact. Policy must meet that standard. And it's good for employers to document the reasons for a policy and document its effectiveness. And employers need to be prepared to reasonably modify or rescind policies if they have a discriminatory effect, even if the effect is totally inadvertent and unexpected. And then I talked about validation, and there's an EEOC fact sheet on employment tests and selection procedures, which says you must ensure that these are validated for the positions and purposes, and there's uniform guidelines on employee selection procedures that should be reviewed. The test or selection procedure, again, must be job-related, and this is shown by demonstrating successful completion of the test is necessary to the safe and efficient performance of the job, and that the test is predictive of success. Employers should also ensure that tests and selection procedures are not adapted casually by managers who know little about the processes, and that a test or selection procedure can be an effective management tool, but should not be implemented without understanding its effectiveness, its limitations, its appropriateness for a specific job, and whether it can be appropriately administered in a way that does not have an adverse impact. If it does, then an employer needs to look at an equally effective alternative selection procedure. And now, I'm going to try to be a little bit interactive, if that's possible here. We're going to have the name that claim game, where I have a few types of situations and want to see if people can say whether it's disparate impact, disparate treatment, failure to accommodate, whether it's a few things. So I'll read through these policies. If anyone wants to stop typing or if they want to start talking, if they have a microphone, raise your hand. But here are some of these policies for the name that claim game. A person with a disability is denied reassignment due to a seniority policy. A worker supervisor often calls him a blind bastard. An employer says, we don't hire disabled people. An employer refuses access to a job coach as only employees are allowed on company property. Or a job applicant who is deaf is told he cannot do a dishwashing job as it is a verbal position. So I'll wait a second to see if anyone wants to offer some input into thoughts about any of these policies before I go through and give my thoughts. It's a hard thing about the webinar. I assume everyone's still there and paying attention, so feel free to type or raise your hand and I'll... Ah, there we go. Deb Dial saying disparate impact. Are you talking about the first one, I assume, the reassignment seniority policy? If so, that is absolutely correct, and that was the case we talked about in U.S. Airways versus Barnett. What about the employee who's called a blind bastard? And this was a case we actually handled, an employee with a vision impairment. Disparate treatment, exactly. Harassment is kind of the quintessential type, or one of the quintessential types of disparate treatment. We don't hire disabled people. Well, that would also be disparate treatment. Yep, Deb's on the, you know, I wish we had a prize for Deb Dial, who's answering all these questions. So let's not see the same hands all the time. Next one, an employer refuses access to a job coach as only employees are allowed on company policy. So Deb, feel free, I'm not trying to discourage you. Oh, we have something from Anel, indirect evidence to show a legitimate of the discrimination occur. I'm sorry, Anel, I just quite can't get that whole question. But Salima says the job coach one is both. I think you're close. And Deb Dial says disparate impact. Yeah, it's a company, it's a neutral policy. You have to be an employee to be on company policy. So yes, it is disparate impact. And is there another claim? I mean, what's the resolution? I think is the person wants that policy waived for their job coach. So I think it's also an accommodation claim. I want the policy to be really reasonably modified so my job coach can come on company property. The deaf job applicant who's told dishwashing is a verbal position, I think that's pretty obviously disparate treatment. And that, again, is taken from an actual case that we handled. And I'm happy to say the person is now working in the dishwashing position. I have a few more on the next slide. We'll play a few more, and then we'll throw it open for general questions. An employee seeks to work at home, but there's no policy allowing it. And a related thing, what if a company does not require that accessible software be purchased, even though an employee requires it? This is kind of, what is an absence of policy? So we looked at neutral policies or non-neutral policies. Here there's no policy. How do we look at those cases? Any thoughts? Yeah, disparate impact? Possibly, but disparate impact is really a neutral policy, and that's coming from Rick. I think this kind of situation, Salima's got it. It's an accommodation issue. If there's no policy, and there's an EEOC fact sheet, for example, on working at home that says if a company has no policy, then they need to see if it's reasonable for that person. If they have a policy, then it more likely is reasonable, but even if there's no policy, they need to look at accommodating the person by allowing it. A policy requires a fitness for duty exam for all persons returning from medical leave. And this may be it seems like it could be a disparate treatment type of policy, and courts have generally held that it's fine to require a fitness duty exam for all persons returning from leave, as long as it's done for every person returning from leave for that position. As long as it's consistently done, the fitness for duty is fine. The next one is a person with MS, and this is taken from another case we handled, for whom driving is an essential function. They're asked to undergo fitness for duty after they have an accident with their scooter. Any thoughts as to that? Neither. Well, yeah, I think it kind of falls into a disparate treatment, and then I think it also comes up into reasonable accommodation. Yeah, it is direct threat as well. I think, and that's why these get blurred. I think here in the case, and this is again, it's taken from a case we worked on, and in fact, that's the Timmons case we talked about earlier. In this case, we argued that it was a they're raising a safety direct threat issue, so the burden was on the employer to show the employee was not able to drive. And while the fitness for duty may have been okay, the employer still needed to look at reasonable accommodations because the ADA says it's a direct threat, which is a significant risk of substantial harm that cannot be eliminated or reduced through reasonable accommodation. There's a long answer here. Oh, Barry's answering it now. Thanks, Barry. I'll take a look at that in a second. And then the last one, a person with mental illness requests a modified work schedule, but it's denied. What kind of case is that? It depends. I think so. I think that's generally, you know, again, if they have a policy, we never give modified work schedules. You can make it a disparate impact argument, but I think Marcy's got it. It's really an accommodation issue. Let's look at the accommodation. Are they qualified? Is the request reasonable? Is it an undue hardship? Is a reason for denying a job related and consistent with business necessity? I think those are the issues that need to be looked at. So I think for a lot of these, I know a lot of people in the room have strong ADA knowledge, so I don't think you really have to worry a lot about the Title VII disparate impact, disparate treatment dividing line so much. I think, you know, it's important to allege the type of claim it is, but I think on these ADA cases, it often comes down to qualified and reasonable accommodation issues. And here are some resources I just wanted to show everyone. The DIPTAC Great Lakes ADA Center, of course, our hosts for this webinar. Equip for Equality, the Illinois Protection and Advocacy Agency for People with Disabilities, where Barry and I are employed, and the Illinois ADA Project, which is funded by the Great Lakes ADA Center and managed by Equip for Equality. The EEOC has some great fact sheets on this, and on the ADA in general, and I have links there to two of them. One is the EEOC fact sheet on testing and employment and selection procedures that I talked about, and the second one is just a informal opinion letter that the EEOC wrote. But in that letter, they discuss disparate treatment, disparate impact, and the ADA. So I think those two links are helpful for people. The Job Accommodation Network, of course, is always helpful in terms of ADA accommodation issues and the ADA Technical Assistance Line. So before we throw it open for questions, I just want to show everyone here's our next seminar. Remember, April 28th is the Major Life Activity Update. And for people who just can't get enough pretext, in September we'll be doing a whole webinar on pretext. And here's the link for the evaluation. I request that everyone please fill out the evaluations and let us know comments, pro or con, anything we can do to help make these presentations better. So I will now unlock the talk key and throw it open for questions. Any questions? Thanks, Barry. Anil was asking about how you show indirect evidence in a failure to hire case, and Barry was saying, well, you can show that the employer consistently has not hired people with disabilities who are as qualified or more qualified than people without disabilities. That would be indirect evidence. Direct evidence would be we don't hire people with disabilities. So thanks for answering that question. And there's a question here from Susan Ross. If jail correction officers are required to meet certain physical conditions and cannot be in a wheelchair, does the staff areas? Oh, that's an interesting question. Does what you're asking, I think, is if a correction officer works at a prison and is in a wheelchair, but they really can't work at the correctional facility in a wheelchair, then does the detention center have to be wheelchair accessible? And that raises a few issues. Well, one, any area open to the public under Title II of the ADA must be accessible. And also, if there's any modification, whether it's a staff area or a public area, that should probably be made accessible as well. But generally, the employee needs to be qualified to request an accommodation. And generally, requesting that staff areas only be made wheelchair accessible would be a reasonable accommodation request coming from the employee, but they need to show they're qualified. So if the fact that they're in a wheelchair means that they're not able to perform the essential functions of the position with or without an accommodation, then they would probably be unqualified, and it would probably mean the Bureau of Prisons or the detention center does not have to make the staff areas accessible until either they're renovated or a qualified employee with a disability needs them to be accessible. But Barry, please feel free to let me know if you feel anything differently. I'll take a look at the other question.
Yeah, I think, Rick, your point is good, and I mean, it just sort of goes beyond what Alan said about if anybody else needs access to the staff area other than staff, well, you wouldn't have to look at the qualified issues like cleaning personnel or other people who might be interacting with the prison in some way in that staff area, then the accessibility requirements would be involved.
I just had one more thought about that. Well, one, I had a thought whether it's really impossible for someone who uses a wheelchair to be a correction officer. I think there are some desk jobs where you look at video cameras or things like that. So I think that would get into an essential function determination, whether someone's really qualified or not to do that job in a wheelchair. And it also depends on who would use the showers or toilets, anyone who has access to it. So if it is possible someone with a disability might need access to it, then it might need to be modified. And then there's a question from Bonnie. If the terms disparate impact and treatment are not used, and I mentioned that they're not used in some of the decisions, even though they seem to fit, but I think what you really need to do in complaints is allege facts that give rise to them. So I think you can allege you were treated differently because of a disability. I think specifically saying failure to accommodate is fine to preserve an accommodation claim or a retaliation. I think it's good to do that. But if you allege a failure to accommodate and they raise disparate impact, I think you might still get by even though you didn't raise a disparate impact claim because you're still asking that they accommodate. But then the fear is that Supreme Court decision where they said it wasn't disparate impact, and even though the policy had an effect of discriminating, we don't look at that because in disparate treatment we needed a motive. But in that case, the person didn't raise an accommodation claim. So I think if you're looking to have a workplace rule modified as an accommodation, it's probably best to raise all three, depending on the rule. If it's a neutral rule, raise disparate impact and accommodation. If it's a rule that obviously specifically impacts people with disabilities, and maybe raise disparate treatment and accommodation.
And just it looks like we're at the bottom of the hour, so we need to wrap up. But Barbara says, with the ADA available, why do we need these claims? And I think, Barbara, maybe we weren't clear enough at the beginning. Disparate treatment and disparate impact and accommodation claims are all – they are all ADA claims. They're all civil rights claims. And – including the ADA. So if that wasn't clear, we've been talking about these claims as they pertain to the ADA. These are general employment discrimination claims, and really whether it's ADA or Title VII depends on which protected class you're in.
Oh, and one more thing. Thank you, Lindsay. Lindsay updated our information saying that employee restrooms and showers are considered common areas for new construction in the ADA standards. Therefore, if there is new construction, they must be designed accessibly. I don't know, that still doesn't get to the retrofitting issue, but thank you, Lindsay, for that information.
So I think we are at the end. If people have other questions, you're free to email us or contact the Great Lakes ADA Center with follow-up questions. You will be emailed the PowerPoint and the evaluation form. And just a plug for our next webinar on major life activities. This is going to be, hopefully a useful one because we do have a new ADA Amendments Act that really gives us a lot more information about major life activities, and maybe between now and then we'll even have a few court cases that help us with interpreting those new provisions. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Claudia to close things up. Thanks, everyone.
Okay. I'd just like to thank Barry and Alan, and I'd like to apologize to everybody and actually thank everybody for your understanding for the technical glitches we had there in a minute. But this is a really interesting session that covers a lot, and as you see, people have more questions and comments that they'd like to think through. So I'd like to encourage everyone to call the Great Lakes Center at 877-232-1990, and we can answer your questions and any other items that were not addressed in the session today. So with that, I just want to say thank you and have a good afternoon, everyone.